The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hi, hang out for just 1 second. Coming up this Friday on the After Party Podcast with me and Kimberly Johnson, it's part three, the final chapter of our special year-end shows about the 1980s. We're going year by year, talking about the news, events, music, movies, pop culture, all the things from the 1980s. We already covered 1980 through 1985 in parts one and two, so this Friday, December 15th, it's going to be 1986 through 1989, the year I graduated from high school. But the only way you can listen is by subscribing to the After Party level or the Ultimate Edition level on our Patreon page, patreon.com/Bob Seska Show. So don't miss out. Again, go to bobseskashow.com or patreon.com/Bob Seska Show. Choose the After Party or Ultimate Edition levels, enter your information, and you're all set. Thank you so much for supporting this podcast, and now let the cartoons begin.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska.
Hi, this is Leslie Nielsen. Merry Christmas, you eggnog-sucking patsies.
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, December 13, 2023, and this is the Bob Seska Interview on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, I'm Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hi, day 1057 of the Biden-Harris administration, 327 days until the 24th presidential election. You can find me on Threads and Instagram at TheBobSeska, Twitter, BobSeska_goes, Spoutable Bob Seska, and our Patreon page is BobSeskaShow.com. Okay, so a couple of weeks ago, I got a DM from Laurie at the All Access Star Trek podcast, one of my favorite podcasts, about interviewing John Billingsley on my show. You might know John as Dr. Phlox from Star Trek Enterprise. He also played a cartographer in a Big Block of Cheese Day episode of The West Wing and so many other memorable roles. So naturally, I said, hell yes, I'd love to talk with Dr. Phlox. Are you kidding me? So it turns out John is one of the principals with the Hollywood Food Coalition, along with his wife, Bonita Friederici, who you might know from Chuck or The West Wing, Bones, and more. The coalition is doing incredible work, feeding more than 80,000 people a year, hofoco.org, H-O-F-O-C-O.org. And on January 13, John is hosting the Trek Talks Telethon to raise money for the coalition. TrekTalks.net for more. Links in the description, as always. And if you're looking to make a charitable contribution here at the end of the year, hint, 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 hofoco.org. Okay, meantime, don't forget to support this podcast by subscribing to us on Patreon, patreon.com/Bob Seska Show. And this is me talking with John Billingsley and Bonnie Friederici.
More fun, more music, the Bob Seska Show.
Oh, man, this is so exciting. Before we talk about the Hollywood Food Coalition, though, I have to check in about your cat, because when we first started corresponding, you said, oh, my God, my cat's got this intestinal problem. Is everything resolved? We have to make sure our priorities are in order here.
All is good. I think our cats both, you know, they bolt their food. And I understand that. That's the nature of cats. It's the nature of me.
Yeah.
But sometimes I think they eat faster than they can digest. We're talking about our cat's intestinal issues, Bonnie. You arrived at the perfect time.
She's like, what kind of show have I gotten myself into here?
We're going to move on. We're going to move on to another topic. I don't want to get Bonnie started on our cat's intestinal issues. Oh, my God.
Can I just ask something? Was there a barf? Is this...
Not today. No.
Oh, you just thought you'd swing that right into there.
Well, no, there's a history. Bob and I have had a history talking about cat barf and, you know, the nature of some of the issues. We have a life, Bob and I, together that actually, I'm sorry, doesn't include you. And I'm sorry I have to break it to you like this, but...
We have a whole thing about intestines and cats. That's kind of our connection. John and I, simpatico on this very specific issue.
Well, Bob, Bonnie, very Bonnie, Bob. Happy for you both. Hi.
Hi, Bonnie. You know,
you pop your chair a little bit so you're more
there's
visible.
There's no room here. It's okay. I like being in the background.
Right. Anybody who knows can tell you that is a lie.
Well, you know what? We've got to talk about how the both of you met, because I was looking through your respective credits and a lot of the same shows were popping up in both lists, Bones, Enterprise. How did the both of you first connect?
Well, it depends upon who tells the story. Yeah, there are variations on the theme of how we met. Mm-hmm. Would you like to tell the embarrassing part about me and then I can tell the embarrassing part about you?
There's no embarrassing part about me.
There you go then.
Of course not. Yeah.
Bonnie says that she saw me in a play, came backstage to say hi to other actors, complimented me, and I didn't give her the time of day because I was busy hitting on another woman. I don't.
Wow. Okay.
True.
Well, it wasn't. I mean, you said that very succinctly. I went to see a production of Great Expectations with a friend of mine who's a lovely, lovely director. And we were sitting there, John played Herbert Pocket, and he was relatively new to the LA theater scene. So both of us were like, who is that guy? He was really, you know, stood out from everyone else in the cast. He's just that way as an actor.
Yeah.
And so I had come to see another friend in the play, and I had given him my regards. And then I was going to go over to John to say how much I liked his work. And he just didn't, he just was fixated on going out for drinks with a blonde woman that I now think I know very well.
I don't know if this is your experience. I find that, you know, in a partnership, when the other person tells a version of a story, it bears absolutely no resemblance to your memory whatsoever. It's like,
that's really? Right. But between the two versions, the versions complement each other. Yeah.
You sure?
Well, see, the thing is, you never acknowledged me, so you wouldn't really remember the story because you didn't even. I just finally walked away.
I don't know. This could just be something you've created from whole cloth. The idea that you praised this complete stranger, and I don't know.
Well, I never actually was able to praise you because you never.
Did you actually speak to me, or were you just hollering from a distance? Hey, you. How do I know?
Well, you were hollering across the courtyard. It was a noise within.
However, how we really met was at a commercial audition that was ridiculously backed up back when we were doing commercials. And we had a mutual friend who effectively served as a chaperone so that we were able to flirt for 2 hours without too much fret. And I asked Bonnie for her number, and she said, in spite of the fact that I don't date people because I think people are basically sick and twisted, I will give her my number.
All right. That sounds great. You know what? We are birds of a feather, Bonita. That's for sure.
Well, I was trying to point out the fact that you just don't know if someone's a serial killer. Like when they ask you out, because you're on your best behavior, right? Everybody's pretending to be great, and you never know. Yeah. Now, I will say John also had a date that night, and he was fretting about the fact that he was going to be late for his date. So,
and I grant you that that is not perhaps the best way to actually, but I get points for candor. I broke up with that girl the first thing in the morning.
See, I'm listening to all of this, and you know what? We could take this entire portion of the conversation, slip it into those interview segments from When Harry Met Sally, and it would fit perfectly, because you've got the great stories, and that's always the foundation, I think, of a great relationship, is to have a great origin story. You know what I mean?
We have been also extremely lucky and blessed. We're very happy. Second marriage for both of us. We met at exactly the right time. We were both segueing from theater into film and TV. We were on the same career path. We had the same values.
Yeah.
We both always had a strong interest in social service and giving back. And it's just been, a match made in heaven.
That's exactly right. And I've got to give a fist bump to Bonita, who's a fellow Virginian. I was born and raised in Northern Virginia. And you are originally from Charlottesville, right?
I am. My father taught at UVA.
Fantastic.
He's a thermodynamic engineer. But we moved from there when I was five.
Okay.
Because my father joined the aerospace industry here in LA.
Oh, interesting.
But my brother did go to UVA also. He went a couple years as an artist.
I didn't have much to say to Bonnie's father because as soon as I found out he was a thermodynamic engineer, my little brain just went,
That's surprising because I kind of peg you, John, as someone who's just in the know when it comes to all that stuff. Like, you're an expert in just about it. Like, you know a little bit about every different field. I don't know why I get that impression from not only you, but the parts you play.
Yeah. I read a lot, but I read a lot of fiction and I read a lot of history. What I know about thermodynamic engineering, quantum mechanics, physics, etc., could fill a thimble. No, wouldn't fill a thimble. I'd still have plenty of room in the thimble to swirl my little pinky.
So cool. Yeah,
he's not the most mechanical minded fellow.
In fact, I have the lowest recorded score in the history of the state of Connecticut in something called the DAT, the Diagnostic Aptitude Test, that tests for spatial relations and mechanical aptitude. Wow. Maybe somebody's gotten below my low bar, but in 1977, my guidance counselor said, I don't think anybody could ever get lower than this.
See, that's
like you got 9%.
Yeah, yeah. But
like a little thing they show you, like, how do I put this flap into that box to make this construct? It's like, I have no idea. I just throw that box out and get another box. Bonnie, would you come fold this box?
See, I will say this, though. You're really good at playing experts. I don't know what it is, John, about your personality, your acting style, that lends itself to playing people who seem to know a lot about everything. There's that vibe. I don't know if anyone said that to you before,
you know what I'm talking about.
Honestly, I attribute it purely to having decent pronunciation skills. See, if you read a lot, you can a polysyllabic word, you can sound it out fairly quickly, and you can understand, even if you don't know what the hell it is.
Yeah,
you can say, "Oh, sesquiterian." Absolutely. I don't know what sesquiterian means. I might not even be a word, but I can just fling it out there. The sesquiterian principle.
That's exactly right.
I don't understand half of what I'm saying. Three quarters of it.
He's a word slinger. He uses very large. I have often said to him, "You do know that no one knows what you're talking about. They're just nodding their head because they don't want to."
I consider that a good thing. I consider that a weapon.
So about 7 years ago, you founded the nonprofit organization People Unwilling to Sit on Their Haunches, or PUSH for short. Mm-hmm. What inspired you to get started there? Let's jump into volunteerism here and talk about that origin story.
Donald Trump. We had been volunteers, you know, at different points in our lives, and it's always been important to me. But Trump's victory, I felt to me personally and what it represented and what I think it spoke to about the debasement of our society, it seemed to demand a response. And I'm political, but I'm not particularly well suited to being in the political arena, which is, you know, sharp elbows and highly competitive. And my wife very graciously was willing to help me figure out what I wanted to do. I pushed acting aside and started thinking about what more community-oriented service might look like. Mm-hmm. And the initial idea was to try and find ways to get a lot of people to help identify for themselves what their volunteeristic bliss was.
Yeah.
And as I began to do more of that, I thought, boy, I could spend a lot of time helping other people figure out what their volunteeristic bliss is, but that's not necessarily my volunteeristic bliss. What do I want to do? Bonnie had at that time begun to volunteer at an organization called the Hollywood Food Coalition. And I just fell in love with it when she introduced it to me. And I thought my talents were probably well suited to helping it grow and clarify what its mission and vision
should be.
Yeah, it's been around for a long time. It's been around for almost 40 years, 38 years. So we were late to that game. They'd been doing amazing work for many, many, many years before we came on the scene.
It takes a special kind of personality, I think, to not just sit behind a computer and kind of do online activism. It takes a special kind of person to interact with people directly and to have a direct effect rather than maybe circulating online petitions or getting into some other form of activism. You're one-on-one with people on a regular basis. Is there something about your personality that draws you to those kinds of interactions?
Well, one, I really want to, and I appreciate your asking Bonnie to join us because I want to give so many props to her, because my role in all candor, I think, was to say, let's get a shitload of people who love this organization together. And that comes from having a theater background.
Yeah.
You know, theater making is intensely communal. You have to value everybody. You have to get everybody in a room. You're going to have arguments. You're going to have fights. You're going to have the clock is ticking. It's an intense experience, even in my opinion, more so than on camera work. Mm-hmm. The idea for me was that there are a lot of people who supported the Hollywood Food Coalition, but hadn't gotten together to talk about its future and what the aspirational model should be.
Yeah.
What do we all want to build here? Because it's going to continue on for a while as a soup kitchen that doesn't generate a lot of revenue and doesn't have a huge following. But eventually you're going to find that people who are the chief cook and bottle washers are going to want to leave, and you're not going to have any money to hire salaried employees mm-hmm. to keep it going. So the idea of bringing everybody together to generate a vision, if it wasn't for Bonnie, who said, okay, some of the things that have emerged is we want to rescue more food and eventually share more food. If Bonnie hadn't on the ground started something called the Pickup Artists, 50 or so people, who many of whom were friends of ours, to rescue food from TV shows and movie sets to feed our own population. Wow. And to begin partnering with other groups. If she hadn't done that, we wouldn't have been able to springboard into something we call the Exchange, which is essentially a mechanism by which we expanded that capacity. We now rescue 3 million pounds of food a year, and we share it with about 130 to 150 other neighborhood groups to buttress and augment their meal programs. And that's Bonnie.
That's incredible.
To be Bonnie every day, who's out there doing so much to build community in our city. It's really, I get verklempt.
Yeah, yeah. It's a staggeringly good idea. Like, that's something that we never really think about. Like, where does that uneaten food go? Food that's perfectly good that could actually be enjoyed by someone, and it just gets thrown away most cases. But that, to actually harness that and use that waste for something that's positive, is exceptional, not just in terms of the landfills and so forth, but in terms of actually feeding people. Such a great idea.
Well, there are a lot of organizations that are doing that.
Yeah.
Across the nation, Food Rescue US, I think. The thing is when we started volunteering 7 or 8 years ago, the word rescue for food didn't function for people. I'd say we're rescuing food, and people would sit there and I go, you don't understand what I'm saying. And they go, no, I don't. What does that mean even? Mm-hmm. And that exactly that idea that it's not trash. A lot of the food that is being thrown into the trash needs to be rescued because it's fully edible.
Yeah.
And that is the thing with television and film shoots and things like that. That's your steak, your fresh salads. Everything that they put out for catering for actors and crew and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's better now, but back then, if you were on a set, the caterers didn't have time to do anything but trash, 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 trash. And it was hundreds of pounds of.
It's a lot of where the impulse came from for both of us, as having been on sets where you just see after the meal is over them sweep through and just dump this amazing food in the garbage can. And it's just like your jaw drops.
Yeah.
But the other thing, and I think this was where Bonnie and I also felt very strongly, is we were the Hollywood Food Coalition. That was the name of the organization. But we weren't doing a lot of coalition building. In fact, it appeared at the time to us as if we were sort of the redheaded stepsister in the community. We weren't particularly well-liked because we weren't, you know, particularly well-known. So we thought one of the most important things was to bring the idea of sharing what we rescue to other groups really to the forefront of our mission. And the idea that we're trying to, it's very hard to do, but we're trying to provide concierge level service so that we rescue food. We talk to the groups who are interested in having food given to them. And we say, what do you need? You are for instance, battered women's shelter. You've got 30 people in your congregation and you have limited cooking capacity. What could you use? How often do you need it? How much? We ask them to let us know, and we don't necessarily have everything they may want, but we can tell them what we do have and what we can provide. And in that sense, it's not food dumping. One of the things we really wanted to avoid was to simply say to an organization, hey, we've got 2 pallets of okra. We'll drop them off at 7, take it or leave it. The large Feeding America is an amazing organization, and I don't mean at all to run down what they do, but they're built to a giant scale. They collect in a giant scale. They distribute in a giant scale. We wanted to say, how do you serve more groups at a neighborhood level and particularly identify in the corridor of need where food deserts exist, those organizations that are being ignored?
Mm-hmm.
And that again, so much of this is Bonnie's work. that to me, you know, my goal was to bring a bunch of people together and to keep talking about what we could do and to create some structure around the board and to a certain extent around staffing back when I was playing a slightly different role than I am now. Mm-hmm. Bonnie is the one who I think out in the field was making this shit happen.
Yeah.
You know, I did some, but you know,
I wouldn't have done it if you hadn't come up with a structure and ideas. And I mean, the whole idea truly of being a coalition, of being able to go out there and reach out to organizations, and like John said, saying, mm-hmm. do you need food?
Yeah.
And the answer being, we do desperately. I mean, what are you going to do but say, let me see your kitchen, let me see your resources, let's talk about this. And what are the services that you're providing? How can we better support that with food? That all came from your head.
But I also want to say that this was built on the 30-some years of amazing street-level service that was provided, particularly by a woman named Sherry Bonanno that we both learned a tremendous amount from. When we started volunteering, these core principles that she'd created, serving a hot, nutritious, multi-course meal every day of the week, never missed a day mm-hmm. in 37 years, and always giving people choice. Would you like vegetarian, vegan, carnivorian, starch with that?
That whole idea of human dignity begins with choice. Yeah. You do not force. It's a lot of times at food kitchens, soup kitchens and things like that, people go through a line and it's spaghetti, and it's spaghetti with meatballs. And if you're vegetarian, you're still going to eat that. You pick out your own meatballs, right? And if you don't, I've had people go through our line who will say, I don't want cheese on my broccoli. Can I have the broccoli over there when you're serving them? Yeah. And having volunteers at the Hollywood Food Coalition go, no, you have to take what I give you. And having Sherry say, that's not how we function. Mm. What would you like? If they want that corner over here, it's a person's right to have some sort of sense of self.
Yeah, and that also gives them a sense of humanity that I think is sorely lacking. I mean, when we often think of unhoused people, we think of people in any sort of need, they're sort of seen as a statistic, or it's a group of people that aren't really people. And in that way, at the very least, they themselves will feel like, well, this feels normal. I can choose. Are you kidding me? This is great. I mean, what a way to brighten a day, you know?
Two other things that I think are really relevant to what this organization does. One is in its history, because we're so volunteer driven. We need volunteers to cook. We need volunteers to serve. We need volunteers to process the food, share the food, pick up the food, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. It brings thousands and thousands of community members into a relationship with the unhoused. So that stigma, that sense of us versus them begins to erode.
Yeah.
And I think we see in our politics today, we see our leaders effectively wanting to stigmatize, demonize, and be punitive towards the other, including poor people. When I hear the people on the right talk about San Francisco or cities, like, it's, I mean, the word vermin is being used by a political candidate is a disgrace.
Yep.
No, human beings are first of all, dignified people, many of whom have fallen on hard times. Our job is to find a way to connect with them through a service that will encourage them to come back and back and back so that we can further connect them, which is the other part of our work, to other service providers who do things we don't do.
So, actually, I was talking to Sherry Bonanno the other day. We were at the exchange slinging some food around. And she was saying that she's always thinking. She wants us as an organization to keep talking about poverty, to keep saying we're not allowing ourselves to understand that there are people who really are on the poverty line. But it's not just people who have nothing. There's a lot of people who just can't afford food.
Yeah. And it's why for us, the motivating force to say, let's partner with a lot of social service organizations so that it isn't just about the unhoused. That's definitely a portion of our population, but it's about all sorts of organizations that help people who've entered either willingly or somewhat unwillingly into drug and alcohol rehabilitation programs. It's people who are in senior citizen centers that don't have a lot of resources.
You know, I actually, we may talk about this, but we give out lunch bags on Sundays to organizations, a lot of lunch bags for them to go do their work and stuff like that. We're at a church, based at a church, and people will walk through and ask for a lunch. Sometimes it's not like we line people up. It's just people might come through. And this last Sunday, a woman probably in her 50s drove up in a car, and she said, what's going on here? And I said, we give out lunches. And she goes, oh. And I said, well, would you like one? And she said, well, yeah, I just lost my job. She goes, I'm not working right now. So that would be really, that would be nice if I could. And I said, you want a turkey, a ham or whatever? And she said, turkey, please. She said, could I get two? She said, I have a friend. And she said, my friend really needs one too. And I gave them to her and she started crying.
Yeah.
And you go, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And she said, thank you guys so much. And, you know,
in an ideal world, the home we would build, and we're a couple of years away from getting off the campus where we currently, in essence, rent, to a place of our own, would want to be expansive enough for the other groups that could provide additional services to be on the premises.
Yeah.
So that people who come to us because there's a wonderful hot meal every night, we can turn around and do a little bit of what we now do, but more. We could turn around and say, there's a legal services aide who might help you get your documentation in order. There's somebody who might be able to help you kind of clear those ridiculous tickets you've been given, you know, so that you don't have tickets anymore. If you have issues with, you know, the fact that you may have gotten out of prison and you can't get job interviews. Let's talk to some job counseling folks. We really want to find ways to help create hub spaces for folks so that when people in need come to us, we can very easily say, let us introduce you to.
That's incredible. So the coalition is more than just the food. It's basically another social safety net
across the board, right? And you know, something that I, because I know you're political and have a political background. I mean, to me, one of my great heroes is Francis Perkins. And I consider that when Roosevelt took office, he turned to people who in New York were building social service programs in the Great Depression and said, what did you do and how did you do it? Mm-hmm. The cities we often talk in our federal system are laboratories for innovation. And unfortunately, we have a weak federal government right now that doesn't create a social safety net. So more and more and more, in my opinion, it is the cities, our towns and our cities, that have to figure out how to deal with some of these problems that are not being dealt with at the federal level. So hopefully the time comes when a progressive administration that has the power to do more, I'm pro Biden, so don't get me wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
Progressive administration has the ability to do more. They can look to innovative solutions all over this country and say, that works. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Ooh, that's good. Oh, and that, look at what that person's doing. Come hither.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Where's the next Francis Perkins? Somewhere out here.
Yeah. I mean, government services can only go so far. It requires organizations like the Hollywood Food Coalition to fill in all of those gaps. And where there are openings in the social safety net, that's where you come in. That's what it seems like.
Although I would say to my way of thinking, in an idealized world, there would be no need for me.
Mm-hmm.
In an idealized world, we would live in a society where the federal government, the state governments, the local governments understand that the need to have a comprehensive social safety net that is paid for by all of us through graduated income tax functions. Because that isn't the world we live in, we're needed.
Yeah.
And that's where, to your question long ago, what PUSH was supposed to be was a way to encourage people to figure out what that meant for them. It became easier for me to think about, what if I just try and dive deep into the thing that means the most to me?
What, by the way, whatever happened to PUSH? Is that still a thing?
You know, oddly enough, there's a group called Hodge, Hang Out, Do Good, that we work with, that did what I wanted to do with PUSH, and I love those people. She has 5,000 or 6,000 folks that she communicates with on a regular basis. She's extremely discursive. She has created a clearinghouse of ideas, actions, much of it political, that she invites her membership to participate in. Mm-hmm. I look at that and I think, oh, that was PUSH. Thank you for doing it. Now I don't have to. I can do this instead.
That's right. I mean, that's what's so great about the atmosphere of volunteerism is if you see a better idea and someone doing it better, there doesn't really seem to be a sense of ownership about your initial idea, as long as it's getting done by someone and getting done effectively, right?
I honestly say, anytime anybody asks, it's like, what can I do? It's like, well, first off, look in your own backyard and find out who's doing cool shit and join them. I mean, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. Somebody else is probably doing something that is amazing, and put your energy into it.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay, short break. Back with more John Billingsley and Bonnie Friederici right after these words.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
You can't always get a clean you can feel good about inside and out unless you're using Bubble Genius bath and body products. See, Bubble Genius is a woman-owned small business proudly creating our vegan-friendly products in America and supporting other U.S. businesses by buying our ingredients and supplies from them as often as possible. Plus, you'll be hard-pressed to find packaging as recyclable as ours. Visit BubbleGenius.com and check out our cause-related items, too, like our global warming soap and a lot more. We donate our proceeds for those items to worthy causes, like organizations combating climate change and mountaintop removal mining. Good stuff like that. We also send our products to the troops overseas through our Buy a Soldier a Shower campaign. Because the least we can do is keep them smiling and smelling great, right? So visit BubbleGenius.com and feel good and clean. Bubble Genius, doing our part to make the world a better place, one bathtub at a time. That's BubbleGenius.com.
Bob Seska! All-time favorites all day long!
How is it possible that the Coalition is the only consistent nightly meal service from Santa Monica to downtown L.A.?
That's well, it's important. It's important to say that, you know, and this is true for cities generally, yeah, is homeless populations. The city politicians want to segregate the homeless population as best they can, so they are not perceived as a citywide problem. Yeah. So the huge majority of people who are homeless are still based downtown. Mm-hmm. There are nightly meal programs that feed more people than we do downtown. It's just that the spread of homelessness across the whole city, and LA is vast, yeah, has meant that there are now pockets of the city where there's a larger homeless population. Mm-hmm. That portion of the population anywhere, be it Hollywood, be it Santa Monica, be it et cetera, is not itself anywhere near the size of downtown. So the need for as robust a meal program as exists downtown isn't there.
You know, going back to that issue, the homelessness issue, is there one thing that people don't understand about whether it's the root cause of the current homelessness crisis or the people themselves? I think there's a lot of misapprehension.
I'll throw something out that never gets discussed.
Yeah.
Is we have a federal government right now that doesn't believe in public education.
Right.
So let's talk about the LA public school system. 40 kids in a class, many of whom don't necessarily have English as a first language. They come from backgrounds where the parents themselves perhaps don't read or haven't themselves graduated from school. You have people graduating from public school who do not have the capacity to compete in a marketplace like Los Angeles, where the minimum wage is roughly $20. They have to survive. Many of them, not all of them, many of them will turn to crime or drugs. Hmm. You get busted, you go to jail, you come out, you get a prison record, you can't work.
Yeah.
So that to me is one of the pipelines to, you know, living on the street. Not right. The only one. I'm not suggesting in any way, shape, manner, or form that people who live on the streets are criminals. I'm just saying that there is one pipeline that to me requires a more robust federal response, and that is education and recognizing that prison reform requires people not to be treated when they go to jail for petty ass drug crimes like criminals who can never have a life afterwards.
Is there assistance that the Hollywood Food Coalition provides as far as drug interdiction? Because I know that both fentanyl and the new form of meth, the P2P meth, has been one of the biggest culprits in terms of keeping people unhoused, where they want to stay close to their dealers. And that's where you end up with some of these encampments, because the high is so quick and the DTs come on very shortly after that. And so they want to be nearby. And so as a consequence of that, that's kind of tying them
We work with a lot of organizations that provide housing and provide access to housing. We ourselves are not in the business of helping to place somebody into a specific program, helping to place somebody into a specific drug and alcohol rehabilitation.
Well, we have a navigator now. Yeah. I mean, this has been a very rapid growth for the Hollywood Food Coalition of being able to actually hire people. When we started volunteering, it was an all-volunteer organization.
Yeah.
Now it has, I think, 29 employees. And one of the hires was to get someone who could stand on the line at night when people are getting their meal service and identify people. That's part of the being able to have people come every night if they want to eat and things like that.
Yeah.
Is getting that familiarity where you can start saying, hey, can I talk to you about what are your needs? And then start to guide them where they can get support.
But the growth of our program and the need to move to a home of our own is because those partner organizations that you want present when you're serving, they can't come in the evening.
Yeah.
So ultimately, we need a campus where there's not only a nightly meal program, but where there's also an afternoon snack where you can come and you can have a cup of coffee, where you can come and read a book in a small library. You have to create a home. And the home is where you have these other groups come. The hardest thing, and you make a very good point, there are lots of reasons why people don't necessarily want to get off the streets. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be separated from their pets. They don't want to be separated from their friends. They don't necessarily want to move into a housing situation where their rules are going to be very restrictive, or they're going to be searched every night, where they can't have people visit. There are a lot of reasons to not be excited about moving. To convince somebody it's worthwhile, you have to build a relationship. And it is a long, hard, slow, arduous process. And then there has to be the housing available, and there simply isn't.
Do you find that you're building relationships with some of the people who avail themselves of the meal services and so forth through those interactions? There are maybe ongoing.
I'm not personally, I mean, I started volunteering, making fruit salads and cleaning dishes, which is certainly not something that I'm good at, and serving a little bit on the line. Mm-hmm. My argument, in a way, is that no one can do everything. I am best suited to help organize a board and to spread a message, to raise money and awareness. So I'm not actually having anywhere near as much personal interaction with our clients as I used to, and as many people in our organization do. But yes, there's definitely a deep sense of intimacy, warmth, and friendship that we seek to establish with our clients. And we have an amazing staff, a wonderful woman, Erin, who has taken over as our kitchen manager, who's just got like, I get verklempt again just thinking about her. She came to town to be an actress. She started volunteering as a dishwasher. She fell in love with the organization. Two babies in, she's now like, you know, I can't imagine life without her.
Just incredible. What was it like running the Hollywood Food Coalition during the worst parts of the pandemic? I mean, that must have been an enormous challenge to get to the place where you're one-on-one again.
We drove a truck through the opportunity, and that's the one I'm proudest of. When that crisis hit, it was like, okay, suddenly the world is waking up and going, oh, fuck, hunger. Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Also, here, all the restaurants and businesses and stuff shut down, so there was a massive amount of food that needed to be placed. I mean, we ended up having a 6-foot-long freezer in our garage because an Argentinian restaurant closed and they had thousands of pounds of meat, and we need protein is huge for a nightly meal, and we didn't have a food budget. We don't have a food budget. It's all donated food for these meals. So we just threw it in our garage because we ended up starting that concept of an exchange at the beginning of the pandemic. All this food became available. John said we should share it with other organizations. A church came through, United Methodist Church in Hollywood, and said, you know what?
We asked. That's the key. We asked. We went around town and said, would you be interested in hosting us? If we rescued food, could we keep it at your place? Could we have people come and pick it up at your place? What would you say to that during COVID? These churches were vacant. One said yes.
They said, we give out food and we can't do it because of the pandemic. We have a huge kitchen. We're not using it. And we have a banquet room, which, I mean, I look at that banquet room. It's for baptisms and things like that. It's a beautiful church. I look at that banquet room and I remember having 14,000 pounds of candy from NBC Universal.
Wow.
Mountains of it. Harry Potter, Hogwarts candy, because they had to get rid of it because they shut down. And we were able to say, okay, we're going to go with this idea of a hub. If you can have food come in, we will sort through the food. We will compost the bad stuff. We'll start putting together these packages. I called them tickets for different organizations to come pick up, and we'll schedule them so that they can get food so they can ride out this pandemic as well. And it caught on. It worked really well.
I'm really proud that we, you know, I mean, it's that ridiculous, you know, and somewhat painful bromide of like, you know, treat every shitty thing as an opportunity.
Yeah, right. And
we did, you know. It was
overnight,
like,
Sherry Banana turned our, we had a sit-down meal service, and we served 200 people at the Salvation Army. People would line up, and it would be like, no barrier. Anyone could have food. Didn't matter if you had money or not. It would be like 65 people at a time could come into the Salvation Army area, and we would set up tables, and people could sit down, and there's that interaction you're talking about with volunteers sitting there and talking.
Yeah.
Overnight, it had to stop because of COVID, and we had to find a way of still feeding people, but you know, not indoors. And I remember going to Restaurant Depot with Sherry Bonanno, testing different kinds of containers to see if we could fit the right, you know, the starch, the protein and all that, and how to package it, how to put it together, how we would afford it.
Yeah.
And how we would, we had to come up with a whole system inside the kitchen to pump out. And now it was 300 people were lining up. Yeah, so 300 meals. And how do you keep people moving through and not sit down and not eat?
But that's the challenge of being not-for-profits, which I think is what makes, you know, I mean, scale is an interesting thing. I think the challenge for an organization like ours is to find a way to keep a sense of human scale, because we're not trying to be the Red Cross and we're not trying to be Feeding America. We're trying to be a tremendous neighborhood resource. If you get too big, you can't pivot.
Yeah.
We had to pivot. We have to pivot. You'll always have to pivot. You don't know where the hell, you know, the next crisis is going to come from, and you don't, you know what on the ground might happen that might require you to rethink the way you provide different kinds of food to different populations. I think the flexibility within the model has been a real strong suit for us.
To be perfectly clear about what Hollywood Food Coalition achieves, 80,000 meals served to low-income and food-insecure people every single year. I mean, that's a gigantic achievement. And also, I think a statement about how many people are being left behind at the same time, too.
Well, and yeah, that's great. And that's what emerges from our nightly meal program.
Yeah.
When I consider what the 3 million pounds of food a year does by in essence, creating meals for all these other groups, that number is actually low.
Yeah.
Bonnie's sandwich program, 3,000 sack lunches. These are very high-end multi-element sack lunches. There's a sandwich, there's a beverage, there's a snack, there's a sweet, there's a fruit or a vegetable, there's usually a note, there's frequently beautiful designs and illustrations on the lunches.
Wonderful.
That's a meal. So those, she pushes out 3,000 every Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 150 additional thousand a year.
Yeah.
So honestly, what I would say in terms of meals served, it's considerably more than that number.
And I love to hear about the quality of the food that you're serving. Sure. And just to go back to that real quick, because what you don't want to do.
We hired an amazing professional chef who said, I don't want to be in the professional world anymore. I don't want to cook for a 3-star, 4-star restaurant. I want to give my talents to people who are hungry.
Right.
It's amazing what he's done to our program.
Yeah, because you don't want to solve the food problem and then create a healthcare problem.
Yeah, and you don't want to give people food that makes them feel like they aren't respected. We work with an organization, tell the Village Services story, which I just love. I love this story.
Village Family Services. That was one of the first organizations where we experimented with saying to their executive director, do you guys need food? So Village Family Services is an organization. They're great. They're in the Valley, obviously. They have two locations and they work with at-risk teens. So teens who are on the street and need housing, and they get them housing and they provide them with counseling, with classes, try to help them get jobs, clothing. Often they're asking me for blankets and hoodies. The kids are freezing on the streets and things like that. And so we said, do you need food for your program? And the executive director, Terry, said, absolutely. Oh my God, we've been praying for this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, oh, okay. And I said, so I went and I looked at their kitchen and they had a normal refrigerator, little kitchen, no stove. Their director of one of their programs bought a George Foreman little tiny grill so that if he got a hold of bread or cheese, he could make a grilled cheese sandwich for the kids. Mm-hmm. And then they would get Panda Express. They would go pick it up in a metal tin. One tin once a week from Panda Express. They put it out hot and the kids could spoon some food for themselves. And we were like, okay, we can do this. We can make this better. And what we started doing, for instance, we hooked them up with the show, The Prom.
The movie.
Oh, was it a movie? With Meryl Streep. in it. And the gag would be, I started it out by going and picking up the food from their set, packaging it, dropping it off to them so they could have it hot for their kids, and then training them to do it on their own because they were only 10 minutes away. And she called me and told me that the kids looked up the show and they were all excited because they realized they were getting the same food that Meryl Streep was getting.
That's wonderful.
All of a sudden they're going from maybe a grilled cheese sandwich once a week to every day. Fried chicken, okra, black eyed peas, cream cauliflower, macaroni and cheese, peach melba. And surprise, surprise, there are more kids showing up.
It's incredible.
And that's the point. It's you've got the food is there, the program works. If you're not feeding the people in your program, you may lose people.
Well, something that was very interesting to me, because it highlights that the whole dignity thing, is that the director who had bought the George Foreman grill, when he was showing me the kitchen, he said, well, you know, we do get a little bit of donations here. And he kind of pointed like that. And I looked at him, he said, but you look, he said, the bread is moldy. And he goes, the cans of tuna and stuff, it's expired. And he said, I don't want my kids to see that. I don't want them to think that that's how much people value them, is to give moldy bread and expired cans of food to them.
Yeah, yeah. Dignity is such a big part of this.
We're working on a margin, and the margin is, you know, when people do donate food, when grocery stores donate food, they're donating at their version of its expiry date, which is not its actual expiry date, but we've got to get that food out quick.
Yeah.
The other thing we do that I always want to talk about is we work as a coalition with other partners to try and figure out what are the systemic problems that require all of us working together. How do you get more refrigeration into the community, into the mechanism? How do you get more storage, more volunteers, more transportation? How can you say, ding, 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 we just got a wonderful opportunity to go pick up a shitload of great food. Ding, 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 who can take it? Ding, 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 where does it go? Got to move fast.
This is the safety net that you were talking about as well. I mean, the idea... I mean, I have been saying this like a lot lately. There is enough food in the world to feed everybody. It's all logistics. That's the thing. I mean, when we were doing the pickup artists, there was a reason why people weren't picking up food from shows. It's because you have to stay on the, you have to text with texting and GPS. You can actually find where the food is and you can text drivers and say, wait, they pushed lunch. Don't go yet. Go in an hour and a half because they won't let you take the food yet. Or wait, go right now. Their lunch is early. You got to get there so we can get that food and get out of there. But it's also driving food around. And that was the whole idea. If we can get cities to recognize, if you put refrigerators everywhere, or storage, if you put storage drop off, I was talking about that with Sherry last week, can we find places where people could drop off food at 2 o'clock in the morning when their shooter, their whatever they're doing is done? They have a code, they open it up, they put the food in there, it gets registered, and someone goes and picks it up the next day. I mean, there are ways to do this, but you have to think.
And that's the long, slow, hard, arduous cook. And you know, as we turn a little bit to the event that we produce that actually tries to generate money for the Food Coalition, Trek Talks, I find myself telling people when they consider whether they want to make a contribution. Understandably, people might say, why do I give money to an organization in Los Angeles? Why don't I just give it to somebody nearby? A,
great.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. B, if you're inclined to donate to us, one of the things that I like to emphasize is not-for-profits have to model behaviors and actions and solutions that other not-for-profits can look at and go, oh, if all the things that we should steal from each other, we should steal those ideas. So what I hope we are trying to do is create notions on the ground that other people can look at and go, I can see how that could work here. Yeah. That's the laboratory that is the Food Coalition.
Yeah.
And the ideas that emerge in the Food Coalition, to me, is one of the things that I like to pitch. You know.
So talk about the Trek Talks telethon, which is January 13th. How did that get started? Because that is the
I was on a franchise called Star Trek.
Yes.
Star Trek started back in 19.
I've heard of it. Yeah.
Yes, I was in the show that killed the franchise, although fortunately the franchise resurrected itself, Enterprise. One thing that appealed to me tremendously about being on that franchise and getting to know a lot of the fans and a lot of the podcasters and a lot of the celebrities is that the ethos of Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry's fundamental vision, is rooted in coalition building.
Yep.
It's the Federation, a federation of change makers, as a pal of mine likes to call it. And the idea that there was such a nice fit between the vision and the and the work the Food Coalition does just led me to think, well, what if we actually used the Star Trek community to help fundraise for the coalition? Yeah. So I started something called Trek Talks 3 years ago, and it is an 8-hour digital convention. There are panels with all sorts of fabulous people. Anson Mount was on last year. Scott Bakula was on. I could go on and on and on. We have scientists, we have producers, we have directors, we have designers, we have actors, we have musical entertainment, and I'm Jerry Lewis, without the panache.
So I should really look forward to seeing you at like 3 o'clock in the morning with your tie undone.
Exactly, with my spangly jacket and my, Bonnie Gordon is my co-host. She provides panache. I gab, she panaches.
Yeah.
We introduce, we la la la, we do all the Jerry Lewis stick. Please, would you consider yada, 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 yada? We give stuff away to people who donate at certain levels, cool prizes. Last year, we raised about $110,000. The year before, about $80,000. I'd love to keep trying to see if we can raise more.
Yeah.
It's a way for us as an organization to spread the word, to get the entire Star Trek population involved. It's also a way, frankly, to kind of continue to do something that I like to do, which is to talk about this work in the biggest sense. One of the things that's emerged is actually a podcast that we now have, which is called Trektivism, which is a podcast that exists for fans and people in the community to come on and talk about the cool shit they do. So that we can raise general awareness of the fact that this amazing population that support this franchise are for the most part progressive and deeply invested in doing shit to help other people.
Yeah, that was one of the things I was blown away by, and I shouldn't have been surprised, but back in the summer, I started a Trek podcast with Mary Trump. It was sort of a take on Star Trek from a political point of view. Like, okay, well, let's look at the political allegory of Star Trek. And I was just blown away by the positivity and togetherness of both the fans and the actors from all the show. I mean, across all the shows. Such a different environment in the Star Trek universe than there would be. And I'm not trying to be competitive or anything like that, but any other sort of genre franchise or universe, Star Trek is unique insofar as there's a sense of community among Star Trek, as I said, actors
amazing,
and fans.
Amazing family. And one thing that interests me, too, is that just, you know, there's a, which I totally get. I mean, I have like, you know, like A-ball celebrity. There's A-ball, there's, you know, minor leagues, and there's like major league. I have A-ball celebrity. But what interests me, and I understand why people who are like, you know, like cock of the walk celebrities might go, I have to keep my, I don't want to. I'm really interested in breaking down an artificial line that exists between celebrities and fans so that we can have experiences together, so that celebrities who may have philanthropic interests could recognize that fans want access. That's what fans want.
Yep.
They want to spend time with you. It's like throw a party at a pub and invite everybody, and instead of signing pictures and charging them, ask them to make a donation to your charity, and now you've just raised $5,000-$10,000 for the charity of your choice, all because you were friendly.
That's incredible.
And this franchise is uniquely suited to that.
Yeah.
And that's part of what I kind of want to keep like pushing, you know?
Yeah, and so for the next Trek Talks, you've also got Tom Wright, who played Tuvix, famously on Voyager, Michelle Hurd from Star Trek Picard, Ethan Phillips, Tawny Newsom from Lower Decks, Jonathan Del Arco, who played Hugh on Next Generation and also on Picard. So many other Trek actors are participating in all of this. It's
Drake Spiner. We've got a Picard panel. We've got asks out to LeVar and Michael Dorn. I don't like to talk about the people we've asked who haven't responded yet. But we've got 75.
Guilt works.
Guilt works. That's right. Yeah. That's right. LeVar, you said you'd call me. No, it's great fun. And also something we take a lot of pride in is that we have a lot of behind that. Nami Melamed, the brilliant composer who has been composing for Star Trek for some years. We've got a segment with her. We've got the women of STEM, including, we hope, Dr. Mae Jemison, the astronaut, as well as some other people who've done extraordinary things in the sciences. Frequently, scientists come up to me, which is just ridiculous because I'm an idiot, and say, you inspired me to do, to become an astronaut, to become a, it's like, that? Well, if you only knew me,
yeah, see,
I can't even hammer a nail, but.
But you're so convincing. Your portrayals of these characters, these experts, you nailed it. And so that's inspiring.
I also play a lot of serial killers. So I you know, in all fairness, I just to say, I think it's wonderful that there's so many people in the Star Trek orbit who are willing to come on. One of the panels is Trektivism. And this year we had iPhoenix, who does something called Trek the Vote, which is attempt to actually galvanize the Star Trek community to play a role politically as progressives. I think she is a hero in our community.
Yeah.
So she's going to come on and be a guest. We've got people who run fan clubs that have a progressive and altruistic spirit to come on and speak. It's soup to nuts, Star Trek. And unlike a regular convention, you don't have to wear pants.
See, big advantage. See, there you go. That, how long does it last, by the way? How long do you normally go again? Three days?
8 hours.
8 hours?
It's 10 in the morning Pacific time to 6 in the evening Pacific. We announce the key, like, ooh la la guests in each 2-hour block, but we want to have enough surprise to keep people kind of like, you know, I can't go to the bathroom. I'll just go in this cup because who might I miss?
That's right. I think Jerry would just go. I mean, just standing there on camera. He would just let fly.
I have not worn pants for 2 years. I don't intend to wear pants this year, by God. In fact, I worked it into the act last year.
Well, we're just about out of time.
January 13th.
Yes.
That's the key. Trektalk.net.
Yep.
We also have a wonderful sponsors. Trek Geeks sponsor us. Roddenberry Podcast sponsors us. Trek Movie sponsors us. And you can also go to HoFoCo.org, which is the Hollywood Food Coalition's website. Perfect. And the link is there. So there are all sorts of ways to watch it on YouTube. I fortunately don't have to be on the marketing and tech talk team, so I don't have to get into the weeds about how, but all the how is out there. If you go.
Well, I'm going to put a link in the description for all of this stuff, the Hollywood Food Coalition, Trek Talks, and make sure everything's covered in the description under this episode at bobsesca.com. I wanted to talk with you extensively about acting and Star Trek and The West Wing and things like that, but you know what? You're going to have to come back. So both of you are invited back. I want both members of this amazing power couple to join me again next year as soon as possible, and we can talk about all the fun stuff too. So
we've played husband and wife together a number of times in the movies, and we have stories.
I'm so psyched. Well, the Trek Talks fundraiser again is January 13th, starting at 9:45 in the morning Pacific time. Trektalks.net for more information there, and the Hollywood Food Coalition is hofoco.com. I love that domain name.
.org.
Yeah. Oh, is it .org?
.org.
Okay, so it's HOFOCO.org. Gotcha. Oh, and my go-to website for all things Star Trek is trekmovie.com. Just want to make sure I'm giving a plug for Tom and Laurie over at the All Access Podcast.
Laurie Olster,
It was Laurie who introduced us, and I'm so grateful for that. Getting to know both of you has been a huge gift for this old Star Trek nerd at the end of a crazy year. So thank you so much for reaching out, and I thank you for your volunteerism and everything you're doing for your community. You're going above and beyond, and that's I can't state that loudly enough.
Well, thank you both. Thanks for having us on. Thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you both. This has been an absolute pleasure. Take care. Have a great holiday season, and we'll talk to you next year. We're on, right?
Well,
count on.
Sounds great. Okay. Good luck with Trek Talks. I can't wait.
As I walk to work, the ground split beneath my feet. And as I palmed my chest, I felt that I was somehow incomplete. I was the shell of a woman that I was supposed to be. Somehow that was less important than the hellscape on 9th Street. By my lunch break, the sky had cracks in the clouds. And as I walked by the lake, I saw my reflection falling down. And if there ever was a sign, the judgment day was finally here. I was immune to any and all shock, confounded, blatant fear. There's a hole in my chest. There's a hole in the street. My TV plays doomsday until I finally fall asleep. And I think some metaphor for life may be riddled in the sky. But until I get away, I'm not dying to try and understand the metaphors within the sky. Da-da, 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 da-da.
recognize me. I unlock the door to my everything's broken apartment. The landlords have taken over now. They eat my soul for rent. And my only friend's a piano that's played itself since I went to sleep. So I turn it on and we watch the coverage of the hellscape on 9th Street. There's a hole in my chest. There's a hole in the street. My TV plays doomsday until I finally fall asleep. And I think some metaphor for life may be riddled in the sky. But until I get away, I'm not dying to try and understand the metaphors within the sky. Until I finally fall asleep. And I think some metaphor for life may be riddled in the sky. But until I get away, I'm not dying to try. But until I get away, I'm not dying to try and understand the metaphors in the sky. But I try and understand the stupid sky.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.